So this is the second part of a lecture or a class on the Enneagram, and Pam and I were doing it together because Pam is very experienced in using the Enneagram both personally, relationally, and professionally. And she was a therapist and then a clinical director for many years dealing with families, individuals, et cetera, et cetera. So she's good. So kind of with the rhythm we worked out is I'll, you know, say a few things and I say, oh, Pam, do you have anything to add? And bam, that gets her going. So then we'll have hopefully some time for questions or maybe not. You never know how this thing's going to go. But we got through basically the first 5 points. And let me give just a little refresher.
Hey, John.
Hey, what?
Just before you get going, I just want to remind people if they want to look at some of the charts that we put together.
I would like to look at
for them. The Enneagram. John, I just sent you emails. So if you open up your emails, you'll find the pictures there.
Oh, there
if you go to the Integral Recovery Institute, and then go to the resources section, you'll see towards the bottom some different Enneagram graphs.
All right.
You pulling them up yourself?
Mm-hmm.
Do you have a thing that has the actual Enneagram on it that we can look at?
Yeah, I just sent you links to several of them.
All right.
Do you see that?
Yeah, I think so. Well,
you could go to the Integral Recovery Institute page and then go to the resources.
Okay. Well, I'll just roll on here. All right. Now that you've knocked me off the road, I have 4 flat tires, I can start again. So,
sure you will.
As I was saying, before I was so charmingly interrupted, so basically we covered a little bit of the history of the Enneagram, and today we'll hopefully get through the next 4 points, and then we can get into some kind of the complexities of it. But you know, let's just kind of say, do a framing thing, the beginning, why the Enneagram, you might ask. Well, brilliantly enough, in the Aqua map, the integral map, Ken Wilber included typology. And now I've really got to ask him about that. Why he, you know, I've had a number of times when it's like, I'm before the Oracle, I can ask anything, but I've never asked that one. But it's just so perfect. You know, the map would really be much less complete and missing something essential. And it's very important to realize that the typologies, and of course there's the Jungian one, and there's astrology, and there's all kinds of different typologies. But I find that Enneagram just seems to resonate deeply with the kind of work that we're doing, which is the work of transformation, broken egos, wounded egos, and also the journey to the transcendent. It's all there within this wisdom school, and you know, Leslie Hershberger says it's not just a hang, but it's a spiritual path too. So in and of itself, so it just really completes and makes a lot of sense using the integral map, and it gives you a great deal of knowledge. So you can, you know, just using the integral map for assessments of yourself or clients or patients or students that you're working with, can immediately kind of just, you know, within a very brief period, figure out, you know, what they got going on the 4 quadrants, where the real damage has been done, what needs to be repaired, what needs to be reinforced, what's going well, the essential lines, the body, the mind, the heart, the spirit, you know, which one of these lines is in deficit range, or which lines need to be propped up, or is it, you know, pretty low all across the board? Where are they stage development? In other words, what are the ethical and moral precepts that they just from their gut respond to when stuff comes up? Is that a blue egocentric, mythic, rather a red egocentric, blue mythic, modernistic, individualistic, or postmodern, green, blah, blah, or integral or whatever? And moving from there, then you get the Enneagram type, so you know, and masculine and feminine, which we talked about in other lectures or will talk about in other lectures. And, man, you have just a lot of information, just all kinds of stuff. And after a while, you know, you just stuff becomes pretty much downloaded to you as a client, rather as a healthcare practitioner or a human being, and you just are able to sense in in a much more understanding wise with some effective way in just almost any situation, whether it's individual or involving, you know, groups of people. So when you work with this with clients, and usually when I'm working with individuals, it begins to emerge quite quickly, you know, in the first two or three sessions. And I'm pretty good at kind of grokking what people are Enneagram-wise. Leslie Hershberger, who's is a friend and she's just really dedicated her whole life to this stuff. And she's very good at it. She gives me high marks for just kind of sensing what people are. And the other rule is that usually when people are kind of in the pathological, really under stress or not doing too well, they really are easy pretty much to understand what point they might be, or to diagnose. I guess that sounds more like a disease, but anyway, to get what point they are, because at that kind of lower level of acting out, you know, the negative traits are not subtle. You know, the five is extremely dissociated, the four is extremely, I don't know, whiny, the three is completely avoiding everything, but is, you know, but getting things done and often doing it in a way that's not integrity and dishonest. The one is very depressed and judgmental, both of himself and the world. The nine is, you know, sleeping a lot. The eight is just creating havoc and burning things down and breaking stuff and hurting people. The seven is just completely narcissistically party animal, and the six is noble always. No, I'm kidding. The six, that's my point. The six is, you know, is paranoid, anxious, scared, projecting, you know, conspiracy theories. Not that conspiracies aren't real. There have been a lot of them noted in history, but sometimes they're just not there. So who did I miss? That's pretty much it. I went backwards through all the six stuff. Well, basic introduction to the sick Enneagram. That could be a new book. So this is really, really cool stuff to know. And when you start working with it, you can actually, you know, different points have different things they need to do to get well. They call it the holy virtues. Okay. And you can start pointing that in the right directions, and coupled with an ongoing inner practice of hopefully using these powerful technologies that we have now available to us, and the techniques that may be, you know, we're inventing them now, or they may be, you know, come from very ancient sources. We really get going here. We, you know, as therapists or guides or coaches, we become really in touch with our own intuitive stuff. And we can, you know, we can just sense into what's going on. And the Enneagram is a great guide. It is also significant in that it shows us that you just can't use, you know, cookie cutter prescriptions like, you know, I'm a six and this is what I do to get sober, so my God, it's going to work for everybody. And that's what I think what people do, and they form schools around that. But Enneagram gives us more understanding of the complexity, yet that there are basic archetypes, you know, that there does seem to be this basic underlying pattern in human development, which is really extraordinary. What does that tell us about the nature of the universe? I don't know, but I think it's pretty cool. Yeah, that there is an underlying pattern. It's not just random chaos, that out of the chaos, complexity and order emerges. Wow, that is amazing. And that's kind of the mind of God, if you will, or the underlying kind of thing that's going on. Once we get beyond emptiness and emptiness hits form, all kinds of interesting things form, beautiful complexity and interesting things. So, yeah, so it's a wonderful tool for working with clients. It's a wonderful tool for self-knowledge, and which is really important, that we wake up, and not only we wake up to our essential selves, you know, deep, the transcendent, but also we wake up to our, in the world, individual self, so that we can become an instrument, a tool, a vehicle to whatever essential, you know, beautiful gifts we have to the world. And all of that takes a great deal of work and effort and practice and time and dumb luck or grace. So there's the need for it. Also, it helps you understand your childhood upbringing. I probably mentioned this last time, but somebody once told me repetition is the law of memory. But that we're not only through our own individual points, but our parents' points. So when you figure that out, it's very interesting. And you start figuring out what your clients are and your brothers and sisters and your best friends and everything. It just makes you just adds a dimension to understanding and the capacity to act compassionately and skillfully that is just extraordinary. So, Pam, you have anything you'd like to add on to that?
No, I don't. I think that was great.
Well, all right. I'm encouraged. I'll continue. So the last time we left us, the hero was tied down in the dungeon, and they had put the candle to the gunpowder stream, and everything was going to blow up. Now, we're 0.5. I believe that's where we stopped. Wasn't that correct, Pam?
Yep, we stopped at 5.
All right, so 5 is the thing.
Well, no, we actually talked about 5.
Ah.
6 is the next one.
Oh, my favorite point. No, anyway, it's not. So I'm a 6. So 6 is basically the basic issue is fear. And different authors have different, labels for the different points. But one of them that comes up pretty often is a loyalist. Do you have any devil's advocate? Do you know any other, Pam? Or anybody, for that matter?
Loyalist, trooper.
Trooper.
Mm-hmm.
Big chicken. No, anyway, so here's the deal. And there's two types of basic types of 0.6. I think 6 is probably one of the more complex ones, because there's, anyway, a lot of stuff going on. But you have the counterphobic 6 and the phobic 6. And the phobic 6 being, the anxiety-ridden person that's just really scared a lot. The world is an unsafe place. And I'm talking on the really kind of deep pathological end of the pool. And so there's a lot of that stuff going on. On the other hand, the counterphobic 6 is dealing with the same issues, but the strategy that the counterphobic 6 has taken on is to be tough, So the world is dangerous. Okay, I'm going to become dangerous, yo. I'm going to be a cop, a soldier, a martial artist, learn how to shoot guns, have my bunker out in Idaho, full of food and weapons, stuff like that. So that's kind of the extreme of that. Pam, you probably 6 is pretty well, since your husband's a 6. Do you want to add anything to that?
Well, you talked about how there's two types, and I see John as really a great example of the anti-authoritarian, counterphobic 6. For instance, John will tend to not stay in jobs where he's got bosses over him who he disagrees with what they're doing. So he, historically would get fired a lot because he would stand up and say, and challenge.
Right. At staff meetings, I'd yell, "Unionize." That made me really popular. I did. I really did that. And boy, did it shake people up.
Yeah. So somebody like John's better. He works for himself. unless there's a really, a leader that has a lot of integrity that he respects, like Gil over at in one of the jobs we had. So that's a big thing. And so the knee-jerk response, to the anti-authoritarian 6 is to just automatically, if there's authority, the knee-jerk, conditioned response is just to immediately, disagree. So the part of the journey for the anti-authority is to actually, step back from that sort of automatic response.
Yeah, experience rejection in all four quadrants. A lot.
And begin to actually consider, well, maybe the authority has a point. So it's been interesting to watch John's kind of journey with that. And then the counterphobic part, John, have you shared this already about, when you finally realized about fear?
No, go ahead.
Okay. So I remember many years ago, he suddenly said, "Oh my God, I'm afraid of everything." And up to that point, really, his fear and anxiety had been pretty much suppressed or repressed. And it was kind of a revelation for him to go, "Oh my gosh, I'm just scared of everything." And that's kind of a turning point for your counterphobic 6s when they realize that they have lots of, fear and that many of their actions are, again, conditioned, just reflexive kinds of actions.
Yeah, and one of the things that I read early on, I heard early on, I don't know if it was from Wilbur or Don Beck or Cohen or where it was, speaking about spiral dynamics, but they talked about the shift from first tier to second tier, and they said one of the characteristics of second tier or this integral level of consciousness is that fear really begins to diminish, you know. And I just went, ah, that is so. And it's really true. In a lot of ways, fear, some of the really, you know, stuff that bothered me a lot somehow has, you know, the fact I'm going to die, you know, that's, I think I've written about that recently. That's really loosened up, you know, due to, you know, dying a lot in meditation over the last 9 years, kind of get used to the process and realize that it's okay. And there used to be, when I was in my deep dark green, which lasted for many years, there was just such a fear, a corporal embodied just terror about what's going on with the earth. You know, I just felt it all the time. I'd go by a bulldozer and just want to blow it up and get angry and feel pain. And I still recognize, you know, the environmental crisis and all this stuff, but there's a deeper knowingness that ultimately it's really okay. And it's, you know, I mean, if you listen, I'm going to put all my music on accessible sometime. I recorded three albums probably worth of songs that I wrote. And you can just tell me going through this phase, man, there was just like, man, it was dark and painful, you know, the stuff I was writing about. And, you know, I was in a band in San Francisco, and they said, John, you're really a great songwriter and all that, but do you have anything that's not so dark? And I was like, well, actually, no. So anyway, that seems to have shifted. And, you know, yeah, the anti-authoritarian thing, I mean, it's not, I really don't obsess about it because I don't have any boss. And I've said often in our current organizations, where the Integral Recovery, IRI, or Iowa Technologies, it's like, I want to work with people who have, you know, pretty stable access to this second tier stuff, and we are the boss. You know, I don't want to control anybody, but I certainly don't want to be controlled. And I kind of respect, you know, they say that, some authors say that when the sixes begin to come to peace with their own inner authority, then they can make peace with the rest of the world. Mm-hmm. And the outer authorities are, you know, not be just so knee jerk about it. And I think that's probably been true over the years.
Yeah, I wanted to kind of highlight the other side more, because there's actually a lot more people who are just sort of your regular phobic or loyalist sorts. These are the people that actually follow the rules, toe the line, do what they're supposed to. You know, part of their growth is actually, you know, again, finding their own inner authority and thinking for themselves and not just doing what everybody else is telling them they should do. And you find a ton of sixes. Actually, often if I'm thinking about somebody's type, I will roll through them. And if I can't find them anywhere else, you know, that they're sort of glaring things, and I usually come back to six. Six is a really common point, actually.
We're common?
Well, not John's kind. John's type of six is not common.
Common, that's okay.
The other one, we say there's the counterphobic and the phobic. The phobic one is much more common.
Right. That's what you don't want to tell a four. Well, that's very, you know, it's very normal. They go, Anyway, so, and yeah, loyalist trooper, man, I'm loyalist and a trooper. I'm really, really loyal to people I'm loyal to. And as Pam can tell you, with my parents right now, I'm just a pillar of iron here, you know. I don't care. I'm, you know, they were there for me, I'm there for them. And yeah, the trooper, you know, I was a soldier, I was a wilderness guide, you know, for years, and just functioning in really challenging, difficult situations, and you just keep on. You know, cowboy on or soldier on or whatever that is. And that's really a part of my, you know, it's just basic, I don't know, core operating system. So enough about that. Anybody have any comments or questions about six before we move on? Well, okay. So we're going to move to a seven. And anybody who's self-identified, save and raise your hand.
Hand raise.
All right. Who's that?
It's Lisa.
Lisa, awesome. Yeah, she's rock and roll. Anyway, seven is the epicure or the hedonist. That's the two of the different titles. And
or the enthusiast.
Oh, my God. Are the enthusiasts. So, you know, sevens are it's all about You know, and we're talking from, you know, deep pathology to, you know, really, really standing pretty close, being very translucent and healed or evolved, however you want to say that. But it's about, the world is interesting. There are lots of groovy things to do. So what are you doing sitting on your butt when there's so many groovy things to do? And let's just keep rolling with this, you know, and it's like this and that. And if you want to, I love manipulating sevens just out of my impish nature. But, you know, when they don't want to do something, I said, you know, if you don't go, you might miss something. You know, and most times I'll end up going or feeling really bad about not going, which is fun for me. So, yeah. And
you're cruel.
No, I know, but I with deep love and respect. So, anyway, yeah, so they're delightful. And on the pathological end of the street, they can be really shallow and narcissistic, and it's just about stuff, 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 stuff. We have somebody very close to us that's like that. Nespa Pam? Yeah, anyway, we don't have people here, but yeah. Boy, did we know that one. And often the strategy of the seven, you know, something really hard happened, you know, growing up, and there's some really dark, painful stuff there. So, man, you know, the heck with, you know, that deep, murky pond there, let's get a boat. And, you know, paddle around and look at all the flowers and lilies and stuff like that. So it's a real, there's a lot of avoidance of suffering because you just want to hang out in the light. And, of course, all the points know that's a prescription for deep pathology and come out in all sorts of ways. And so there's that just compulsion to run to the next thing. And so the depth work is like necessary for all of us. But to get the seven to go down into the depths is amazing. And when they do, a healthy seven is just a delight. They have a real ability to just illuminate the universe around us and show us what a beautiful, precious, groovy place this is, you know, in spite of everything. So, there's a lot of enthusiasm. And Pam, would you like to speak to that?
Yeah. I learned over time that having a seven as a staff, if you're working with people, is wonderful because they're they're going to bring in play. And as you guys know, you know, sobriety can seem like such a bummer kind of thing. And so sevens can really be instrumental in helping people realize you can have a great time and be sober.
That's right.
For instance, we had a staff for a while who was a seven. And he was always getting the group to go and do things and keeping them active and experimenting. And it was a wonderful element that he brought to the group.
Yeah. And the students could say, you know, well, if that's sobriety, it looks great, you know.
Yeah.
So Lisa, do you want to add anything to this discussion?
Well, just how certainly under stress and in disintegration, we can look very one-ish, and our internal dialogue can be extremely judgmental.
Mm-hmm.
We'll sit at the television and just judge the newscasters, the advertisements, it's just this ongoing litany of judgmentalness. So that, you know, a seven going to one can be really ugly. So I have to consciously, like, that's sort of the temple bell that I can notice, oh, hey, you know, something's going on. Snap out of it. And also, like, I have an eight wing, so I can easily get typed as an eight. And I tell people, like, one of the ways, especially in one of the pitfalls, you know, I have friends of mine and myself who are kind of rookies at the Enneagram, but know enough to be dangerous, learned early on the mistake of typing other people without any depth of information about them. But I explained to a friend who was an assistant that I was an eight, that with me, I'll take a leadership role, but I don't like to stay in it. I'll take the leadership role, especially if there's a task that needs to get done so we can get it done and I can go play. Not because I think I'm the only one who can do it right. So I'm very different from an eight that way, but we can look alike because we'll take over. You know, we're bossy. We'll take over and we'll run the show. But we do it from a completely different motive, and it's fascinating to me. It's just fascinating stuff. I mean, the whole Enneagram thing, it just gets deeper and deeper every time I look at it. And I'm married to a nine, and sevens love nines because we get to be the center of attention.
And, so true.
Oh, it's all about us.
And nines are perfectly happy to let you be the center of attention.
Yeah, I have five best friends, all nines.
That's so funny.
So very self-involved and narcissistic. But when we move towards five, it really is a beautiful thing when we go in deeply, and it's great when we have people in our lives that pull us into that, and, you know, it's just a real gift. So, yeah.
So what are the healthy aspects of five that you integrate in, when you move toward five as a seven?
Well, definitely going internal.
Mm-hmm.
I was even typed as a five in a workshop once because I was in a workshop, and I was in a trance state. And, you know, I was in a trance state. Like, you haven't met me yet. You've met my five. And I can go, yeah, real internal, will stay with something for a long period of time. So, we just become far more rooted.
Yeah, you know, so I'm not sure that we've really talked about a lot of these different aspects of the Enneagram that Lisa alluded to, that there's a path of integration and disintegration. So she talked about how the seven goes to five on integration and one on disintegration. And then she talked about wings, that she's got an eight wing. We're going to get into more of that in a little bit, but just to sort of put some context to some of what Lisa was talking about.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, being a seven, I'm very obsessed with myself, so I've studied it hard.
No, that's why Leslie.
I don't know much about your point on the Enneagram, but I know about mine.
Lisa, I love your insight. I mean, clearly you've done so much work on yourself that you're just comfortable with, you know, sharing. Anyway, it's cool.
And laughing at your foibles, you know. I mean, that's basically, at some point you have to do that. And you start seeing when you get into it, and you can just be gentle with yourself and get back on track. So last, did we start with one?
Yeah. Right.
Okay, so we have two more to go. Okay, so eight. The oh my god, eight is the protect. So it's a protector here. Hmm. I don't know.
It's also the boss. The challenger.
Eight is like just a really powerful point. Okay. And I, as a six, historically had all kinds of issues with eights, because eights are the power and sixes fight the power, at least the counterphobics do. And a lot of times when you meet a real counterphobic six or an eight, it's kind of hard to tell the difference. And I've been typed as an eight before, and I was like, no way in hell I'd rather shoot myself. But there's similarities. But the eight is all about power. Who has it? Who doesn't? And like empathy and sensitivity is not exactly their strong point. I mean, they will just zap you. And oftentimes an eight will go into, especially in, you know, kind of the industries that Pam and I have been working in for the last couple of decades, have been largely green. And, you know, it's about gentleness and sympathy. And you get an eight in the crowd and they just stand out like a sore thumb. And they hurt people's feelings and alienate whole groups of people. And we always use this antidote when we're teaching about AIDS, but there was a graduate program in the Bay Area for transpersonal. I won't name it. But anyway, in the student interview, when they figured out you were an AIDS, they go, sorry, we don't do AIDS. Next. You know, because often, you know, the disgruntled eight will be like Samson in the temple, you know, they'll bring it all down or try to, and they just cause all kinds of stuff. However, if they ever do get it together and they start getting on the path of integration and wholeness and health, they move towards the two, which is the giver, the helper. It's about service. And, you know, not too many eights get there. Okay. A lot of them end up in prison and, you know, just a lot of weird stuff. But when they do, look out, world, because they can truly be a Moses or Martin Luther King Jr. or a Mother Teresa. They have tremendous power. And I think Mother Teresa might have been an eight. I saw a film of her where she was just unbelievable. And not this, you know, soft little Catholic mystic nun. I mean, she was like a drill sergeant in the service of compassion, and really, really amazing to see. Which would probably be a good point for an eight. So, and a thing to remember about the eight, which I've learned with clients, is that all of that ferocity, that force, that strength, like don't mess with me or I'll knock your block off, energy is to protect a very, very tender self inside. Mm-hmm. And when you get that and you can speak that, it's like, it's really, I mean, you can't just walk up on the street and say, oh, you're just a little gummy bear, you know, they'll slug you. But once you, you know, you earn that right, they really appreciate it and they really feel seen. And they sometimes they'll break down and cry and they go, yeah. And often when, you know, an eight does just, you know, crash the scene and does the, you know, the bull in the china closet type of thing, they go, what? What do I do? You know, it's like they didn't get it. So when you're working with eights, you often have to act as a mirror and start showing, okay, now this is how not most people aren't like you, and this is what you do, you know. And, yeah, and so they also say that different countries have their own kind of Enneagram points. That's a whole other discussion. But they say Russia is an eight country, and we were there recently. And it really felt like an eight country. And also Israel, interesting enough, was an eight country. It's like, oh, mess with Israel? Yeah, right. And, yeah, so anyway, I won't get into the country thing, but it's interesting to me. So any other comments anybody has about eights or questions?
Yeah, I've got a bunch of stuff, actually. So excellent. As a nine, I actually have usually really liked eights because nines, we tend to kind of go to sleep and wander along, and you can't really do that around an eight. They'll stomp on you if you're not awake and present.
That's true.
So I came to value them pretty early on because I had to show up in my life if an eight was around. So I tended to like them. I could, you know, sense into their sort of tender inner self and knew that a lot of that sort of dense stuff was protection for that. I found in my early days as a therapist that I always wanted to have an eight staff because I wasn't very good at challenging or being confrontive in the early days. And I could rely on an eight to do that with students that needed to be challenged about their thinking or their behavior, that kind of stuff.
By the way, Pam has worked on that.
What's that? Oh, yeah. Well, yeah. Well, I was going on to say I actually didn't need that later in my career because I was able to access that. But early on, you know, I balanced that by trying to have an eight involved. And also as a therapist, I was working with the kids in the field in the wilderness setting, and then I would be on the phone with the parents. And often I would get, you know, I'd get this fellow on the line who I could tell was probably an eight, CEO, something or other. And I would just sort of feel myself get powerful and strong because I know that what eights, you know, they settle down if they feel like you're strong too. Mm-hmm. Part of the thing with an eight is if they sense weakness, it makes them anxious. And they kind of like the rhinoceros that has to go and stamp out the fire. Their sort of instinct is to go and stamp out the weakness. Because it's actually like a repressed, you know, side of themselves, you know, the weak, tender self. They're also called the Venge. That's what Helen Palmer used to call them because they tend to, if they're hurt, they want to take revenge. And when I'm helping kind of assess people, I'll ask them, you know, do you plot revenge? You know, do you carry grudges for a really long time? Da 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 da. And that can be one of the signs. And then I guess as a therapist, it can be challenging to work with eights because one of their main defenses is repression. And so they can have this great insight, and then 3 weeks later, it's completely gone. It's kind of stunning how much they can repress. And so it's really important to develop tools for helping them anchor those insights, you know, writing, acting out, you know, sort of grounding in different ways. There's some NLP stuff even, you know, kind of anchoring, body anchoring, stuff like that. So, and then lastly, just two more points. One is that occasionally five eights can hide out. When they're under stress in a new group, sometimes they can look like a five. And I've been fooled initially a couple of times by that. So you have to be kind of careful because eights can kind of hide out. And they get the lay of the land, and then they come charging out. Now, not all eights are like that. There's no way they can hide. They're just sort of who they are. And as John said earlier, they don't even have a sense about what a big impact they're having on the group that they're in. And then the last comment I just had is that I often call them the angry victims when they're on the negative side.
Oh, yeah.
Because they have this funny way of having all this power and energy, and yet it's marshaling in this kind of victim consciousness. It's quite interesting. So anyway, If you recognize sort of the angry victim thing happening, that may be an 8 kind of on their pathological side.
Excellent, Sam.
Yeah.
Anybody have any follow-up comments or questions about the 8?
I just have a question. It's Lisa. It sounds to me like you're saying, and it makes sense to me, that with an 8, like if we're dealing with an 8 in a group, or somebody we suspect is an 8 or is in an 8 energy, that the best thing to do is not meet it with aggression, but definitely not cave.
Yes.
Like, yeah.
Absolutely. And they can really destroy a group. If you're doing a group process and 8's there, figure it out early and then take steps to address it, because they can end up derailing the whole group with all their agenda.
Yeah, I've seen it. Yeah.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. I mean, that's one of the things in facilitating groups that, and when I'm actually counseling others, you know, we look to see if it's an 8 that's doing this. And usually, like what I do is, like, you know, you do have to be powerful with them in the group and make it clear you're not going to let them take over the group. And then you do some side work with them as well.
Brilliant.
Yep. Yep.
Yeah, it seems like when they feel heard, they soften.
Yes, yes. Yeah, you have to figure out how to join with them and meet power with power.
Very good. Okay, so last but not least is 9, right at the top of the Enneagram, the top of the pyramid for some mysterious reason. And it is the peacemaker, the mediator, it says on here. And Pam is a 9 and a self-identified 9. And Pam, you want to say a little bit about that?
Yeah, sure. So we're the peacemaker, and we see ourselves that way. We want our environments to be harmonious, and we don't handle it well. You know, when we haven't done work on ourselves and people get stressed or emotional around us. I can remember as an adolescent, if people got into political debates, I would get up and actually leave the table. It was just so difficult to be around. And when they first were running John and I through training to become wilderness guides, they pretty clearly realized I couldn't go work with the adjudicated kids because I was just too soft and wouldn't have been able to handle kind of the aggression. And, of course, obviously I developed over time, and the oppositional kids became my favorite kids, but not in the beginning. It was good I chose a profession that actually really helped me develop the weaker dimension. But we also, you know, we're known for being lazy, slothful. I think sloth is the vice.
Yeah, they just check out and stay in bed and read romance or, you know, fantasy novels or something like that.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I don't know if you guys remember this, but when I was a kid, there was a children's book called Ferdinand the Bull.
Yeah.
He was this really peaceful bull, and he would just sit there on his haunches. Punching on flowers, watching the clouds, you know, and the birds and all, while the other bulls are, you know, young bulls are running around and butting each other, or I don't know, bull's butt, or whatever they do, you know, being very aggressive. And he was just a peaceful little checked out guy, you know. And also, 9s tend to have pretty permeable boundaries, I mean, ego boundaries. And so they can be very empathetic, which could be a blessing or a curse. But they tend to, you know, make pretty good therapists because they can really sense in to what other people are doing. And if you can learn to do that skillfully as a tool and not to be overwhelmed by it, it's certainly, you know, a good skill. And when nines are on the descent, going into stress, they go to the 6. It's all about fear and survival and, you know, all this. But when they're getting it together, they go to 3, which is the achiever, the performer, the doer. And, man, I've seen Pam, you know, from, you know, just, you know, I see both parts of her, you know, it's like, oh, it's the weekend, or are you going to get out of bed? You know, it's like that thing. But then when she's on, she can do the work of 3 people. I mean, amazing amount of energy and stick-to-itiveness and just get her done. It was a wonderful thing to have in startups, you know, healthy 3s or, you know, or healthy 9s or that. I mean, you want healthy everything, actually. But, yeah. So, and I've noticed that as, you know, I've continued to work on myself that talking with clients and whatnot, that my, of course, sixes have that anyway. We kind of have this kind of, we can develop a kind of intuitive psychic sense because the six is always scanning the environment for threats. You know, it's like, hey, the world's dangerous. So you have to, you can't just like check out. You always have to be aware and observing everything. And so you can also begin kind of that intuitive reading people, you know, because, but it's basically out of fear to know. But you, you do the work and you move into that, that kind of healthy nine place. And I've noticed with my clients now, man, I'm sorry, my mom just came in. Bless her heart. Anyway, that intuitive sense gets really strong, and I can just, like, recently I've been just, I said, you know, this image just keeps coming back to me, and the client will go, oh, I had this dream last night. That was exactly it. You know, stuff like that begins to come online. So it can be really, you know, useful when you're working with folks.
I'd like to just chime in as a nine. It's Heidi talking.
Hi, Heidi.
Hello. Sort of about the integration and disintegration thing. It's so clear for me when I all of a sudden I'll be stressed out and won't really even notice it until suddenly I notice I'm feeling really paranoid. And I think, oh my God, I've just slid down the thing to six. And it's so clear. And then that wakes me up, just like Lisa was saying when she slides over to one. It's a wake up call, like, oh, okay, but, you know, try to get more balanced and get out of this stressful situation. And then the exact same thing when I get really productive and feeling really on top of the world and energetic, and I realize I'm in three mode. That's great for a little while. I tend to try to milk it because it's sort of rare. And then, but I miss my nine. I miss the more interior, quiet place of a nine when I'm in three for very long at all. So I hurry back to nine if I can.
Well, you found some great organizations to work with where the interior is always stressed, and you found a great place to live.
Right.
You know?
Yeah.
Another thing about nines is we kind of have this belief that we're not important and that we don't really matter. And so what you'll see is, you know, nines will kind of hide out a lot. And so part of the work is beginning to identify what is important to you. You know, what are your needs? Because, I mean, you know, as Lisa said, you know, it's pretty funny. We're comfortable typically around, say, sevens because it allows us to sort of hide out. Sevens will take all this, you know, the space and the stage. And then we get to hang out and be supportive and, you know, that sort of thing. And then, and also, though, but we'll get frustrated because our needs aren't getting met, and we're not putting it out there that we have needs. So that's part of the challenge. And as John said before, the permeable boundaries, you know, is part of that as well. Just really, twos and nines can sometimes look similar because both merge, but nines tend to sort of merge in a more global way. So nines are often can sort of become sort of mystics easily in a way because they don't have a lot of, they're not as bounded. But nines can merge with the rocks almost, or the trees, whereas twos tend to merge more with people, you know.
Yeah,
they're sort of a one-on-one thing.
Sticky. I mean, with an unhealthy two, it's like, please, give me some space.
And I have a good friend who's a two, and I'll be talking, and she will finish my words with me. And we've been working on it for years, and she still does that at times. That's kind of a typical two merging behavior, you know. They actually end up talking with you as you're responding.
Awesome.
Can I ask a nine question?
Yeah.
It's Lisa. So I'm married to a nine, and he's a doer nine. He's merged with nature majorly. But he checks out. The way he checks out is into gullibility and putting himself on the bottom of the list, and sort of like, whosever opinion he was around last, you know, I find myself bringing him back to, well, what's your opinion? And then he snaps out of it. He's fine. But can you talk a little bit about the gullibility thing with nines and how to support that best?
Well, you know, I think that's probably, you know, it's a peacemaker, you know. It's like, it was like Neville Chamberlain, peace at any cost. Well, that was a really bad idea. So it sounds like in order to, you know, peace, he begins to merge with, you know, the latest opinion. So you don't have to, You know, you don't have to oppose it. So that's one strategy for not rocking the boat, if you will, is and not developing your own, because when you develop your own perspective or your own opinion or your own passion, it's gonna put you in conflict with a lot of other people. You know, and when there's no there, what's there to compete with, you know? Or what's there to push against? So, Pam, do you want to say anything about that?
I think, Lisa, what you're doing is exactly, you need to sort of like help the nine get in touch with what they really think, what really matters to them.
Yeah. Okay, good. Yeah, it's just such an interesting gullibility. Like, I have several nine friends, and they tend to fall for every multi-level marketing scheme out there. And it's like, oh my God, really? You know,
it's interesting. I certainly have some dimension of that, but I think probably I've actually dealt with it by becoming a lot more skeptical.
Yeah.
Well, so I've sort of swung on
what I'd call a highly evolved nine.
Well, actually, I also have an eight wing, like you.
Yeah.
So that gives me some of that as well. There was another piece I was going to say to this.
And sometimes when Pam and I and Pam's yelling at me, I'm going, enough, stop it. She goes, this is really positive. It's growth. And I'm going, well, I'm glad it feels good for you, you know.
I know what I wanted to say. And that is that, and Heidi, you can chime in as well, but nines often have a really good gut. We're body-based people. Mm. And so even though we may not, like my gut will tell me something's not right about a person or interaction, I won't really know what that is necessarily. I'll just know something's not right. And there was a character in the past who will remain nameless who, you know, my gut was like going crazy. Don't trust this person. This person isn't good. Warning, warning, warning. And it took a while for some other people around me to sort of figure that out. And my gut tends to be pretty good about people. And I don't know if that's true about all nines. I don't know, Heidi, maybe you can weigh in. But I've just noticed that my body gives me a lot of really useful information.
I certainly agree on the body giving information, and not just about people, but really about everything, situations and traveling and even camping out in the wilderness, whether I'm safe here or not. I can sort of feel the good place to go camp if I'm alone, and I can feel all that. And then my problem is I can't articulate it very well, and because I'm feeling it really strongly, but I really, and that's where you're so good, Pam. You've learned to articulate these feelings, and for me they're just sort of a morass of feeling without words that so I need to work on being able to express what I'm feeling. But I don't feel very gullible, particularly, Lisa. I feel very suggestible, but not gullible.
Yeah, that's probably the better word.
Okay. I do feel very suggestible. But, yeah, I don't, like, fall for the scams and stuff. But if someone says, oh, this will really make you feel much better, you know, if you listen to this, I will feel better.
Do you guys find that spouses and family members who tend to be in denial with their addict, that are sometimes nines?
About addiction, I don't know. This is Heidi, but boy, denial, I feel like could be my middle name.
Okay, because it's my husband's too. Like, he can completely deny. He denied that his business partner was taking him for a complete ride, and the guy was headed to 20 years in jail, and I'm going, dude, like, how do I explain this to you? Guy's a crook. And, you know, so there was like, he can be very aware and very intuitive, incredibly intuitive, but then there's just some times where there's this denial thing. And I just wondered if that nines were commonly a denial partner in the unhealthy ranges.
I think so, aren't we, Pam?
John?
Yeah. No, I agree. Of course, all of the points when it comes to addiction have their own version of denial.
Yeah.
You know, it's really, really strong. And you know, it's interesting you're talking about and I've become much more to listening to my body. Sometimes we're interviewing somebody about a partnership or this or that, and I'm just going, hey, my body's freaking out, you know, and I realize I don't know exactly what it means, but I know it means something. You can always trust your body. And you know, and I'll say, Pam, okay, my gut, my body's like going nuts when this guy talks, and then, now if you want to, you know, take this on, you can handle it, but as far as me, it's just going no how, no way. So that's probably me moving into to picking up that. And the points are also broken down. 8, 9, and 1 are called body points. So they intend to, when something happens, they lead with their bodies. In other words, it'll be sensate. They'll feel it. And the 2, 3, and 4 are called the heart points, which means they try to do something. They try to fix something. Like if there's stress or things going on, the 2 will get helpful, and the 3 will try to fix it. And what will the 4? What is the 4's version of that? Well, they get really codependent, you know. And
they want to have sex. That's what they do.
Oh, really? I
had a 4 tell me that when she her strategy was to try to use that to become intimate.
Yeah.
Out of danger.
Hey, there's zombies in the front yard. Hey. So, and the 2 would go out. Hello, zombies. How are you guys feeling? You're probably rough being a zombie. You know. Anyway, so and the 3 would like make a barricade that would be really, really good. So anyway, and the 5, 6, and 7s are called the head points. So they try to figure things out. They lean much more into, the analytical, intellectual aspect. So, and again, when you're moving to across the Enneagram to the point that where you evolve or you integrate, you'll take on the healthier aspects of whatever those points might be. So, in my case, it's kind of the intuitive 9, peacefulness, instead of the anxious, paranoid, angry, or challenging 6. Okay, so let's see how we're doing. Well, we have just a very few minutes left. Pam, is there anything you wanted to add to what we have here?
Not to the 9 thing, but certainly it would be, I feel like we actually really kind of need to cover integration and disintegration, wings and subtypes, but it sounds like that's going to be part 3.
I don't think we can even begin to give dignity to that or express it well in 3 minutes or whatever we have left. So let's just open this up. Are there any comments or questions that are emerging? And remember, this will be recorded, so, other students will be able to, listen to this later. So,
yeah, I, it's Lisa again. I have a question. As someone who just doesn't feel qualified, sometimes it's obvious what somebody's point is, but sometimes it's not, and a lot of times it's not, unless I know their internal experience. And, so I hesitate to type people myself. So my question is, in working with people, is it best to encourage them to investigate the types, maybe point out a couple they may want to look at? What tools would you use to support them in discovering what their point is if you're not certified like you guys are or experienced to the level that you guys are?
Yeah, that's a really good question. And, the traditional answer is it's a self-identified. You just read all 9 chapters or, take a test. And the tests, don't work all the time. I took a test and I was an 8.
Yeah, Don's test is kind of iffy, but it sometimes helps a little.
Yeah, well I'm such an intuitive when it comes to working with people. But when we were doing, integral recovery residential work, like I said, people who are really unhealthy are really easy. And so because they're really manifesting the negative aspect, it's right there in your face. And so I was, about batting 1,000 with students, and I just said, okay. And we didn't have a lot of time together, so I just kind of wanted to hit the ground running. So I would break, the traditional rule and say, okay, read chapter 3, read chapter 4. And they'd come back often devastated or like, oh, wow, somebody gets me, So that's what I do. But I think the thing, might suggest a couple of points. You can eating dinner and keep flashing, a 3 fingers at them, stuff like that, if you want to be more subtle. But no, so yeah. And some people
– which John's probably done.
Yeah, right. But, sometimes it's hard to know. I've got, there have been people that have stumped me for a while, and I had I guess I can say that Diane Hamilton, is a 2, and she's a neighbor of ours. Zen teacher, really cool, integral person anyway. And she just, I didn't know what she was. And so I just said, I think you're two. Now, that was just my gut right at the beginning. Then we went through a process of about 2 or 3 years. And I heard going to all kinds of classes and stuff like that. And then one time I got a text. I got it. I'm a two. So, you know, she was hard, but it turned out I was right originally. So,
I want to chime in here because I have a slightly different view than John on this, which is I really think it's important to respect the person's process in discovering what they are.
Yeah.
So I take the more feminine approach. John takes the more masculine approach in this area. I really, you know, like people to, you know, I like to ask them questions to help them through the discerning process and obviously give them things to read. You know, and I may or may not tell them what I think they are, depending on, you know, whether I want to influence it or not. I just encourage them that ultimately this is up to them. It's part of what, you know, it's part of what they need to sort out for themselves.
So you see the different strategies of a nine and a counterphobic six. You know, I mean, that's just like, there it is, you know.
And a dude and a chick.
Yeah. Well, yeah. And Helen Palmer, who started the narrative, and, you know, like she feels it's really important to not impose points, you know, what you think somebody is.
Oh, she's real hard about that. Yeah.
Yep.
She was real intense about that. And the only other quick thing I have, just sort of an observation, but would love to hear anything you have to say about it, is the two. And the tendency of women, I see a lot of women type themselves as two, based on our conditioning that we need to be the helpers. And I have a friend who's done a lot of work, but boy, she's stuck in that two. And she is such a nine that it's just like, it's just such a nine. And I just wondered if you guys had that experience too, that women, because of our conditioning and towards being the helper, tend to put ourselves in the point of two when maybe we need to look a little further.
Well, that's a really interesting question. But, you know, we come from Utah, and it's very, especially in the county we live in, it's very Mormon dominated. I mean, everybody's Mormon, 80, 85, 90% of the people. And in Mormon, you know, religion and whatnot, women are not allowed to get into positions of serious leadership. You know, they're not the apostles, the prophets, the ward stake presidents, what all that stuff is, you know, and they're always relegated to the helping thing. Now, you ask a Mormon, say, well, and all the woman's power is this and that. But I really find a lot of two-ishness in Mormon women. They're very helpful, and they, you know, that's what they do. So it's a really interesting study. And I think that, for example, I have a Israeli friend who's a nine, and he comes over here, and everybody thinks he's an eight. You know, he says an Israel. An Israeli nine feels like an American eight, you know. It's what happens when you grow up in a, you know, an environment that's always in the process of getting shot at or shooting at somebody. You
sure.
Know, it's become very forceful, not to mention the Holocaust and everything else. So, so over there he was seen as a peacenik hippie, and over here he's seen as an eight, which is kind of interesting. So I think culture does have a lot to do with it.
I think it seems like culture has a lot to do with how people appear, but what their real point is on the Enneagram tends to not be that conditioned behavior, just like you're saying. It's like they look like an eight because of their conditioning, but he's really not. You know, it's like I just seem to have met a lot of women who just finally discover after years of thinking they're a two that they're not.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yep.
And they learn a lot, like they get so much value out of discovering, oh my God, I'm not a two, and that's why this isn't working for my relationship, looking at the Enneagram points, because
right.
I'm not a two. So I just wondered if you kind of had that too. So thank you. That explains a lot.
What you're nicely pointing out is the topology of the masculine and the feminine, really.
Yeah.
You know, that this is a layering that can influence people's self-perceptions.
Yeah, you know, and the U.S. is largely, you know, seen as kind of a three type of culture. And, you know, you can say a lot of things about the U.S., but normally they don't say, oh, the U.S. is such a lazy country. We're not lazy. We tend to just go and dominate and create things. And, I mean, we've been very busy since 1776, if you want to put that as our official birthday. But then again, we have a lot of the, you know, on the pathological end of the pool, we've got all that unhealthy three stuff. It's like whoever, you know, owns the most Tinker Toys wins. It becomes really shallow and about accumulating stuff and gadgetry and riches and, you know, to hell with everybody else, you know. And, of course, when the three gets healthy, or America gets healthy, it moves to the loyalist six, you know. And if you want to kind of hear the healthy soul of America right now, I would say listen to Bruce Springsteen, his latest, well, maybe his all his work, but definitely his last two or three albums really bring that back in, you know. And we're, of course, being here at my parents' house, we're bombarded with, I'm bombarded with Fox News every time I walk in near the kitchen. You know, so we just say, oh, it's about green, and green is good, and compassion is evil. You know, the whole Ayn Rand, you know, programming. Nobody realized where it came from, you know. So, anyway, so, yeah, so at our best, we rock, and at our worst, like all of us in Ernie country, we, you know, we got issues for sure. And I go to three, you know, when I'm getting unhealthy, and I notice that on the tennis court, how freaking just what a competitive jerk I can be. I just want to win. About any, and it's really brought, you know, I don't manifest it that much, and so it's really been a really good tool. Well, good tool for me too. Yeah, there you go. So, I think we're like, are we like over the? Yeah. Like,
yeah. Fine.
Okay. Hey, you guys, thank you so much. And
thank you.
Know this, that we are right in the golden age of Enneagram revelation. Okay, so this is not a static thing. It just, I mean, since we began learning it back in the late 80s, it's just deepened and deepened and deepened. And same thing with the whole integral map and the whole integral process. It's the more you look at it, the more you see, and you just get into empty, you know, into vastness when you go in. Same thing with our interiors. The deeper we go, the bigger it gets down there, and the more roomy. There's a lot of stuff. So, hey, thanks everybody, and you know, study hard, practice hard, work hard. Because that's the only way to achieve.
Play hard.
Excellent. Yeah. As
the
seventh chimed in, play hard. Okay, God bless you guys. Thank you.
Thanks, Ron. Thanks, Ben.